Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Here we are, 3 weeks since the election, and our picture of the Trump economy is firming up nicely from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 30th of November. Good as always to have you here, everybody. There is a whole lot to unravel in the coming American economy today. A new Treasury Secretary appointment, same for commerce, and as yet, undefined deal to save 1,000 jobs in Indiana. Another tweet storm from the president-elect to unpack, because sometimes there is news in them, not just middle-of-the-night ramblings. We start on this Wednesday with the big picture, the overview, if you will, courtesy of Neela Richardson from Redfin and Felix Salmon at Fusion. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
So I'm going to play a piece of tape for you here, Felix. It's from Steven Mnuchin, the new nominee for Treasury Secretary of the United States by President-elect Donald Trump. He was on CNBC this morning with the guy who's been nominated for Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross. Mnuchin, I should say, is a Goldman Sachs partner and a hedge fund guy. Ross is a private equity guy, so both very Wall Street-y people. Anyway, here is Steven Mnuchin on CNBC this morning talking about what they're going to get done.
Our most important priority is sustained economic growth, and I think we can absolutely get to sustained 3-4% GDP, and that is absolutely critical for the country.
Felix, is that real, sustained 3-4%?
It's not as bad as the 4, 5, 6, 7% that all of the Republican candidates were wheeling out during the primaries. It's still improbable, but at least it's moving in the direction of, like, plausibility.
What has to happen, Neela, for us to get to 4% growth? And we should note that the most recent quarter came in at 3.2 on a quarterly basis.
Well, what the Trump economic team thinks needs to happen is a tax cut.
Right.
And so that's the focus, at least in terms of driving those profits to stay here at home, is to bring a tax cut that would lower the statutory tax rate from 35% to 25%, or 15%.
15% on companies, yeah.
On companies, but it doesn't deal with the small detail that most companies don't pay 35%. Most companies don't pay corporate taxes at all, and that the actual rate is way lower than that they actually pay. So how do we get growth from that? It's still hard for me to tell.
Felix, one of the other things that happened this morning on CNBC was that either Mnuchin or Ross said, listen, we're going to lower the corporate tax rate, and all the money that is parked overseas is going to come back, and companies are going to spend that and generate real growth and generate paying jobs for American people. Companies don't normally do that recently. Have they done that?
Well, there hasn't been a tax holiday on repatriated overseas earnings for some time.
Yeah.
If they were to announce that, I don't think that simply lowering the go-forward corporate tax rate would suffice to incentivize them to do it, although it might change a bit of things at the margin. Maybe they will put some kind of holiday in and maybe the money would come back. But to Neela's point and your point, even if all that money came back and even if the profits were higher, that in and of itself doesn't create GDP growth.
Right, exactly. Neela, can we talk about the swamp for a minute? Because Mr. Trump made much of draining the swamp out on the campaign trail. And here we have now what arguably could be thought of as adding water to the swamp, because you have a hedge fund guy in Mnuchin, a Goldman Sachs partner at Treasury. You have Wilbur Ross, a private equity guy. And yes, you want people who know the economy in those jobs, however, comma, right?
Right, comma. So the question is, are we just moving around the chess pieces in a game that's already been played? And it looks like that for right now. The solutions don't seem particularly groundbreaking, and they don't seem to service the middle class. And so the question going forward is, how can we how can this team, this establishment team, even if it has a new face, generate change for people who need it the most? And we still don't have an answer to that.
Felix, what do you think?
I think that not only are they Wall Street guys, they're also real capitalists. You know, they're corporate raiders in many respects. Mm-hmm. They are the avatars of capital as opposed to labor. Both of them have made money by firing people as opposed to by hiring people. And on top of that, neither of them has any kind of government experience or even, as far as anyone can tell, had any real sort of political ideology up until 5 minutes ago. So I'm not optimistic.
Felix Salmon at Reuters. I did it again. Felix, man. It's Felix Salmon at Fusion. I'm going to write it on my
forehead. Thank you, Kai.
Felix Salmon at Fusion. Neil Richardson at Redfin. Thanks very much, you two. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, it was, you know, fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. He's been at Fusion now for years. You'd think I'd know better, right? Okay, so about the aforementioned tweet storm from the president-elect. Mr. Trump tweeted this morning that he is going to hold a press conference on December the 15th to discuss, quote, leaving my great business in total, adding, quoting again here, legal documents are being crafted which take me completely out of business operations, end of quote. 140 characters is a tight limit, yes, but there is still much unsaid and unclear about what that all means and how it might work, especially given the complexity of Mr. Trump's commercial interests. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York now on what those new arrangements might look like.
Let's start with what the president-elect is proposing, or at least what he's hinting at. He's talked in the past about turning management of the business over to his kids, but importantly, he hasn't said he'll transfer ownership or that he'll bar his children from talking business with him when he's president. For a bipartisan group of ethics watchers, today's tweets fall way short.
That is not enough to resolve the profound conflicts of interest that are raised by his business interests.
That's Norman Eisen, former top ethics lawyer for President Obama. He and his counterpart from the George W. Bush administration, Richard Painter, proposed that Trump sell all his assets and put them into a blind trust. That could be done through an IPO or private equity deal, neither of which would be simple or fast. That doesn't make sense to Seth Barrett Tillman, lecturer at Maynooth University's Department of Law in Ireland.
The optimal answer is not that he needs to sell his assets, because I don't think that would accomplish anything, to tell you the truth, but to use an independently managed blind trust.
He says family members could even be on the board of trustees as long as the majority is independent. Other ideas out there include an insurance policy against possible business losses linked to policy decisions like Vice President Dick Cheney used. Rob Walker was formerly chief counsel of the Senate Ethics Committee and is now an attorney at Wiley Ryan.
It's never going to put the potential for appearance questions to rest in the mind of some people. But that's almost always the case when individuals of high wealth go into public office.
There won't be any simple solution given business conflicts that are unprecedented in American history. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, let's spend another couple of minutes here on the new cabinet appointments, specifically Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary and what he is actually going to do in that job. One of those things he's going to do is oversee big parts of the American housing market, specifically finance and mortgage lending. The thing is, Mnuchin's been involved in lending before, as Felix alluded to, and it did not go so well for a whole lot of homeowners. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
Since the financial crisis, the Treasury Department has overseen Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which either own or insure 46% of all mortgages.
I think that the really big place where the Treasury Secretary is going to have an impact is going to be on housing finance reform and really what we should do with Fannie and Freddie.
David Rice is professor of law at Brooklyn Law School. Mnuchin has said he wants to let Fannie and Freddie get out from government oversight. How all that turns out will determine how a lot of people get mortgages, how much government support they get, and at what interest rates. Having Steven Mnuchin at the helm for these discussions is a bitter pill for housing advocates.
Mr. Mnuchin profited handsomely for activities that resulted in harm to thousands and thousands of working class people.
Kevin Stein is with the California Reinvestment Coalition. Mnuchin and other investors took over a failing mortgage lender in 2009 called IndyMac. They renamed it One West, and it proceeded to foreclose on tens of thousands of homes nationwide.
In a number of our surveys, One West was identified as amongst the worst servicers in terms of helping people stay in their homes when counselors thought that was possible and should have been the case.
Mnuchin and other investors sold the bank for a profit of $1.5 billion last year. Robert Jackson is professor of law at Columbia. He says Mnuchin's appointment gives him pause, but he sees a silver lining.
In order to get the housing market started again, we really need a Treasury Secretary who understands how it works.
Mnuchin's precise understanding of the housing market will be coming under a lot of scrutiny in the weeks ahead. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's nothing to see here, folks. Move on.
Lo and behold, there was politics and fracking and the EPA. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, gained about a point, 19,123. The NASDAQ down 56 points, 1%, 5323 there. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.25%, 21.98. Big news day for commodities. For the first time in 8 years, OPEC members agreed to cut oil production. It'll give crude a boost in the new year and, in fact, today as well. ExxonMobil up 1.6%. Chevron gained 2%. Oil producer Occidental Petroleum shot up 5.6%. Wall Street was thrilled with President-elect Trump's pick of two of their own to head the Treasury and Commerce departments. Goldman up 3.5%. That's Goldman Sachs. Bank of America jumped 4.5%. J.P. Morgan and Citigroup each gained about 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I mentioned that deal to save 1,000 jobs up top. The deal in question is between Carrier, the heating and air conditioning company in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Donald J. Trump, the president-elect of these United States, who promised during the campaign he would get Carrier to change its mind about moving 1,400 jobs to Mexico. We have called James Briggs. He's a business reporter and columnist at the Indianapolis Star. James, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We should say at the outset here, there are a whole lot of specifics we don't know about this deal, right?
Yeah, we're waiting for those details to come in. We may not know much until tomorrow, but we know that this was an agreement reached by the Trump administration, which included Indiana Governor and Vice President-elect Mike Pence, but we don't know what types of government incentives were involved. We do know some type of state incentives were part of the deal, but we just don't know what.
What kind of jobs are we talking about here?
Yeah, so these are the types of jobs that people just can't find anymore. These are high-paying manufacturing jobs. The highest-paid workers at Carrier are making $26 an hour. With overtime, they can make more than $70,000 a year. And these are jobs that people didn't necessarily need a college degree to get. So these are very valuable jobs for workers and for the city.
What is the company saying to you? What is the union chief saying to you in terms of how this deal came to be?
The company so far has said nothing other than confirming that there is an agreement in place and that it will save close to 1,000 jobs. The union president so far has said that he's not been involved in any of these talks. He doesn't know much about the negotiations or what this deal will mean. He doesn't know if the company is going to ask for concessions such as pay cuts from the workers. So there really is not a lot of information for the union president and the officials or the actual workers who are still waiting to find out what this agreement will mean for them.
This is 1,000 families in the Indianapolis area that will be getting paychecks, that will be able to pay their mortgages and car payments and have money in their pocket. But talk to me about the wider manufacturing base in Indianapolis and Indiana and big picture where this fits in.
Yeah, so Indiana is still one of the biggest manufacturing states in the country. But these jobs, I mean, just like everywhere else, they're endangered. Manufacturing in general has been getting a lot more efficient, which has been leading to job loss. Now, the economy in Indiana is actually quite healthy. The unemployment rate has been hovering around 4.5%. In the Indianapolis area, it's actually been a little bit below 4%. So there are jobs to be found. It's not actually that hard to find a job in the Indianapolis area. But a lot of the jobs that have been coming here are like distribution jobs, things like working at Amazon, working for UPS or FedEx. And those are jobs that pay maybe $12 to $15 an hour. So that's it's a big pay cut.
Even though Carrier now is keeping some of its jobs in Indiana, you close your piece in the paper this morning with another company called Rexnord. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so Rexnord is another manufacturer that announced just a few weeks ago that it also will be closing its plant and moving jobs to Mexico. Those are 300 jobs there. And those are probably workers who are wondering where their deal is today. This really was a targeted agreement for one specific factory of one specific company, but it doesn't really do anything for the broader manufacturing sector, which is still bleeding jobs, not only in Indiana, but across the U.S. So I think that also, that shows sort of the kind of the weakness of this approach to offering incentives on a company-by-company basis.
James Briggs, he is a business reporter and a columnist at the Indianapolis Star. James, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Item number 5 on President-elect Trump's list of things he is going to do to save or create jobs in his first 100 days reads as follows. I will lift the restrictions on the production of $50 trillion worth of job-producing American energy reserves, including shale, oil, natural gas, and clean coal. You take that to its logical oil and gas conclusion, and that's going to mean a lot more fracking, even where landowners oppose oil and gas wells because they're worried about pollution, because you got to pump water and chemicals down those wells to fracture the rock that holds the oil and the gas to get them out. The thing is, the Obama EPA gave fracking a big green light last year. It published a long-awaited study of fracking's risks that basically said, no big deal. A lot of scientists were surprised, but the public debate pretty much went away. Marketplace has learned, though, that the EPA's headline no big deal message was a last-minute change, a change that has raised questions of manipulation and politicization of scientific research. In a collaboration with the investigative unit APM Reports, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The EPA study came as a divided America was telling itself two different stories about fracking. That is, shooting water underground to break up rock and release the oil and gas inside. One story is of innovation and energy abundance, fracking re-energizing the old energy economies in Texas and North Dakota and Pennsylvania. The other story is about the risk that fracking contaminates water supplies, leading New York in the U.S. and many other countries to ban fracking. Into this high-stakes debate came the EPA study, 5 years in the making, with an unexpected conclusion. Here's Deputy Assistant Administrator Tom Burke announcing those preliminary findings last year.
Hydraulic fracturing activities in the United States are carried out in a way that has not led to widespread systemic impacts on drinking water resources.
No widespread systemic impacts.
According to the feds, there is no evidence fracking has had.
Industry jumped on this positive conclusion. A finding suspicious of fracking would have been a huge roadblock. Instead, the oil and gas companies trumpeted the EPA's words, especially in states that are still debating fracking, including Maryland.
The government has concluded that hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, does not do widespread harm to drinking water.
Except Marketplace and APM Reports have learned the controversial phrase was inserted very late in the process. We obtained several internal draft versions of the study's press release and its executive summary. That is the abridged version that most people, including most journalists, actually read. The documents were confirmed independently by people with knowledge of the study. The draft press release, just one day before going public, had a more cautionary tone. Its focus, quote, study shows potential vulnerabilities. But by the next day, the focus had changed to no widespread impact. In the executive summary, that phrase was put in with just 5 weeks to go in a 5-year study. That was right around the time EPA and White House officials met to discuss messaging for the study, according to internal emails. So, who made the changes?
I would highly doubt that the groundwater scientists who were involved in a technical sense wrote that statement.
Dominic DiGiulio is a former EPA research scientist. He says there's not enough data for such a blanket statement. Modern fracking is pretty new, and most data belong to companies that don't have to share it. We asked the EPA about the late edits. Tom Burke, who announced the study, agreed to an interview but then declined. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy also didn't speak with us. The agency emailed a statement, which reads in part, EPA is working to finalize the assessment to be responsive to the comments received. The study's final version is still pending. Here's where we have to be very straight with you. Because EPA leaders did not talk to us, we don't know who made the late changes or why. we did speak to 13 current and former agency scientists with knowledge of the study. Some described the no widespread impacts line as head-scratching, surprising, and bizarre. Others are more critical, quote, irresponsible, and overreach. Either way, that line, again, no widespread systemic impacts, was called into question after its release by the EPA's own science advisors. Some called it a value statement instead of a scientific one. University of Iowa environmental scientist Peter Thorne chairs the advisory board.
We suggested that they provide a definition of systemic, a definition of widespread, and then provide quantitative data to support the conclusion, to put that kind of scientific rigor behind a statement as broad as that.
The advisors also said that the executive summary's top-line findings were inconsistent with the actual study. Earth system scientist Rob Jackson of Stanford, author of several fracking papers, calls it a mismatch.
The headline, saying no widespread systemic influence, and yet a body of the report that documented a lot of cases of things that could have been done better. And now that mismatch makes a little bit more sense, to be quite frank, as we hear about the change in the message towards the end.
To him, the late edit gave regulators what he calls political cover to go easy on industry.
It's not Watergate, but it completely alters the take-home message of the report. It also raises lots of questions. Who influenced the final conclusions? Did they alter the content of the report in any way? We'll probably never know.
And he wonders if this is connected to three EPA retreats from high-profile fracking contamination investigations in 2012 in Pennsylvania, Wyoming, and Texas. The EPA excluded data from those places in its study, but the agency advisors suggested it reconsider. What's clear is the EPA was called in to settle a long-standing dispute, and it appeared to vindicate and to absolve fracking, says longtime energy regulatory observer Kevin Book. His D.C. firm, Clearview Energy Partners, provides research to oil and gas investors.
That's a big deal. That reinforces the sense that there's nothing to see here, folks. Move on. The idea that the EPA is above regional bias gives it an additional power to an EPA absolution of a technology.
A technology that has swamped the U.S. with ultra-cheap natural gas, that has put a number of coal and nuclear plants out of business, and it's helped to crash the global price of crude oil. There's a lot riding on North American fracking, and Washington knows it, says ex-EPA scientist Dominic DiGiulio.
It's a very powerful industry, of course, and there's a lot of pressure that's put on EPA to not have findings that would cause financial harm to that industry. The wall between politics and science is not completely solid, you know, at times.
And the next administration is even more overtly pro-oil and gas, notes Michael Halpern at the nonprofit Union of Concerned Scientists.
We're really concerned that science that is critical to protecting public health and safety will be more vulnerable to suppression or spin.
For all the questions about EPA messaging, here are a few things the study actually found. Fracking chemicals sloshing around in pits and transported by trucks can induce spill and leach into the ground. Some fracking goes straight into drinking water resources, which in some cases are actually mixed in with the oil and gas. And wells can be poorly constructed. About 3% of the time, the study found, wells lacked outer cement to protect aquifers from contamination. Now, here's where the science gets tricky. The overall pollution instances were low, which could suggest fracking is safe, or that there's not enough good data.
And fundamentally, there aren't strong conclusions from this.
George Gray is professor of risk assessment at George Washington University. He's former head of the EPA research office under President George W. Bush.
We're not seeing a lot of problems, but then it could be because we're not looking closely enough. Right there, you know, choosing which one of those to focus on is going to put a different spin to the way that you look at that report.
Again, the EPA study is not over. The final version could drop the line about no widespread systemic impacts after criticism from its own advisors. And that press release with a controversial line, it was removed from the fracking study's main website a couple months after it came out. One EPA media staffer said the release was bumped to the archives to accommodate a newer link. Another said the press release didn't get enough attention. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott reported that piece for us with Tom Scheck of APM Reports. We'll be right back. This final note on the way out today, one more indication, should you need it, that the Trump administration will be like no other. We told you about Mr. Trump's tweets this morning about leaving his business operations. Well, midday or so, the following tweet showed up on the verified timeline of the Office of Government Ethics Twitter account. That is the agency whose job it is to prevent conflicts of interest in the executive branch. Here you go.
At Real Donald Trump, brilliant. Divestiture is good for you. Very good for America.
It's important to note here that nowhere did Mr. Trump mention divesting himself from his company. That's a very specific thing. Anyway, then this tweet came.
At Real Donald Trump, OGE is delighted that you've decided to divest your businesses. Right decision.
And then this one.
At Real Donald Trump, bravo. Only way to resolve these conflicts of interest is to divest. Good call.
There were 7 or 8 tweets in all, and it is tempting to think the account got hacked, but an agency spokesman put out a statement saying that they were real, so government ethicists trolling their future boss? I don't know. Gutsy move, man. Oh, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow flat today, 19,123. The NASDAQ down 56, about 1%. S&P 500 off 0.25%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.